My name is Jadeep Singh, and I'm currently a visiting lecturer at the University of California, Davis, and I'm a doctoral candidate in the Department of Comparative Ethnic Studies at University of California, Berkeley.
And what is your area of expertise?
Well, my focus is on, you know, I'm a U.S. historian, and my focus are the intersections of race, class, and gender in American history. And I have a specific focus on Asian American and African American history, with a good deal of my research dealing with contemporary American race relations.
Okay, great. So can you tell me about Punjabi people? Who are they and where are they from?
Sure. The Punjab is a region in northern South Asia. About 2/3 of it is in modern-day Pakistan, and 1/3 of it is in modern-day India. And Punjab means five rivers, and it's the land of the five rivers, and is very much an agricultural heartland of India. And the language historically spoken in this region is called Punjabi, and that's very common in South Asia, that states will be demarcated along linguistic lines. And so the Punjab is a state in both Pakistan and India, but it's also a region that's much older, you know, the naming of that region is far older than both of those nations, which are only about 55 years old.
And so Punjabi is ethnic identification?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's linguistic and cultural. But it also has, it is linguistic, right? The language is Punjabi. And, I mean, but it's also very much a ethnic identifier in terms of it's associated with a type of food, a type of dress. And in many ways, it's associated with the people of the Sikh faith, because that's where the Sikh faith was born about 500 years ago.
Can you tell me a little bit about the Sikh faith?
Sure. The Sikh faith was founded by Guru Nanak, and it was essentially a reform to the Hindu and Muslim faiths, which held sway in South Asia at that time. And it's a monotheistic religion, which essentially stretches egalitarianism, both in terms of gender, race, and all these, basically these earthly distinctions are not classified as all or recognized as equal, regardless of race, class, or gender.
And so, when did the first Punjabi people come to the
U.S.? Well, the first Punjabi started coming to the U.S. in the late 1800s. But the actual, there wasn't an actual large-scale movement, migration of Punjabis until the first years of the 1900s, of the 20th century. And the actual time of migration was very small because of executive restrictions that were put in order by the president beginning in 1907. So there was only about a three or four-year period, in which there was a significant movement of Punjabis. And again, it was a very small number total. It was only a matter of a few thousand total. But by 1917, another act had been put in place which limited rather strictly, the migration of all people from Asia. And then 1924, the infamous Barred Zone Act, the 1924 Immigration Act, which essentially cut off all migration into the United States from the non-white world. And that, again, related to the 1790 Naturalization Act, one of the first acts of the United States Congress, which defined as eligible for citizenship for naturalization only free whites. And since basically no one, the 1924 Immigration Act made clear that unless you were eligible for citizenship, you could not migrate. So in essence, it cut off migration from the entire non-white world. And that was in place until 1952, from 1924 to 1952. Mm-hmm. Well, there were several reasons they left South Asia. Certainly, there was economic dislocation. There was a famine that struck the region. In addition, it was the region was under British colonialism. When was what? The late 1800s, early 1900s. That was part of it. There were repeated cycles of famine as well as disease. But one of the main issues that was One of the main issues that certainly pushed Punjabis out of South Asia was British colonialism. Because, I mean, it's rather remarkable how much the British were able to actually extract from South Asia. Even in the midst of famines, revenues would continue to go up in terms of taxes. And so another major issue was there is certainly, you know, Punjab is a finite, there's certainly a finite amount of arable land in Punjab. And so the Punjabis, basically the oldest son would usually inherit the land, and the younger sons would have to find a way to support themselves and their families because the subdivision of land was such that you couldn't continue to subdivide it among all the sons. And so multiple, you know, if there are multiple sons in a family, the younger sons would often have to find other ways to support themselves, such as joining the army or, in the case of many Punjabis, going abroad. Well, the first South Asians that came to the United States, and again, these were South Asians, primarily, there were primarily Punjabis, almost entirely Punjabis, primarily Sikh, and with a much smaller number of Muslims and Hindus. And so when they arrived here, they found themselves in a tempest. Beginning in the 1850, the year after the Gold Rush started, significant numbers of Chinese began to migrate to the United States. And essentially, they created the West Coast economy in terms of agriculture, fishing, industry. The Chinese did all, you know, everything from draining the delta and making that land arable to, you know, basically creating and introducing the fishing economy to the West Coast as well as the agricultural economy. They were essential not only in creating the land, making it arable, but also building the irrigation as well as farm labor. But in 1882, they cut off the United States. There was a and this is a constant cycle. You know, racism is certainly cyclical in American history. And the 1870 Depression, Chinese were blamed by and large for a lot of the problems economically. And again, it's ludicrous because the entire number of Chinese that migrated during this entire period, you know, ended up being a little over 120,000. And there was one particular year in the late 1800s where there were more people just from the country of Italy that migrated. So, I mean, the numbers we're talking about are very small. And it's rather remarkable because in the year 1880, over 95% of Chinese were located in just three states, California, Washington, and Oregon. Yet the United States Senate and the House of Representatives, Congress passed a law which essentially excluded Chinese, despite the fact that most Americans had never seen, let alone met, a person of Chinese descent. Yet because of the racial hysteria, they passed a national law, went through, you know, was approved by a majority, an overwhelming majority of Congress that excluded Chinese. And so it was in the midst of this racist hysteria, which, as I mentioned, is certainly cyclical in American history, and it was directed at the Chinese, and certainly precipitated and exacerbated by economic problems within the nation, specifically the Depression of 1870. And so by 1882, Chinese were cut off, but they still needed labor. And so to fill the void in a rapidly expanding California economy, Japanese were brought in. And by 1907, however, Japanese migration was also cut off because of racist reactions by the white working class primarily. And it was at that point that Punjabis began to become part of the labor force as well as Koreans. But again, the time of migration for both groups was very short. So while there were over, you know, well over 100,000 Chinese and Japanese, Koreans and South Asians, because they came at the tail end when this racist hysteria had reached, you know, such a boiling point in terms of legislation being passed, in terms of the white working class rising up, and a tremendous amount of racial violence. At that point, by 1917, essentially all migration from Asia was cut off. And well, certainly, they were different, right? When the first Chinese came, they were certainly referred to as in local media as the Celestials. And the first Chinese were initially actually welcomed. It was only later that they began to be that this hysteria, racial hysteria, began to rise for their exclusion. And so, into this tempest came South Asians, and they, in some ways, looked even more queer and different because they were dark skinned, they had turbans, they had beards. And they didn't speak English. And very much they were rustic, Punjabi rustics, as historian Joan Jensen describes them. in that their culture was very important, and they weren't arriving in the United States attempting to take on the characteristics of American culture. You know, their food was important to them, their dress, their religion. They were here to work, to make money, to save their, to help their families. And, that's a really important thing to consider. One of the things that typically happened with the Chinese, Japanese, and all Asian groups, including South Asians, was that white employers, the capitalist class, actually favored them tremendously over the white working class because they were far harder workers, according to these early documents that the employers, journals and things like that from the time period. And, I mean, it makes a lot of sense because if you have a family at home that's relying on you, you can't afford to get drunk and waste your money. And so constantly the Asian workers, and again, this is basically across the board, and certainly with South Asians it was the case, they were praised for being reliable workers, far more reliable than white workers. And, of course, this was, this certainly contributed to the racist hysteria in that, although the fact, certainly was that, although South Asians, like other Asians before them, were part of a dual wage system, and that for doing the same work, they were paid less than whites. The white working class was still, they perceived them as a threat to them. And so instead of targeting their ire at the employers who were choosing to hire Asians because they were better workers, according to the employers, they directed their rage and mixed it with xenophobia and racial hostility and directed it at the Asian migrants who were, in very much a desperate situation economically. And had to work hard. They couldn't afford to lose their jobs.
And were the Punjabis
treated differently? I'm thinking about those court cases in 1910 and 1913 when which judges decided that Punjabis were entitled to be considered white. Was that different from other Asian groups? Can you speak about that?
Well, which
case is in 10 and 13? Are you talking about the Balsara case? Okay, well, the thing with the Balsara case was it wasn't at the Supreme Court level. So what happened is Balsara and a few dozen South Asians were granted citizenship on the basis of being, that 1790 Naturalization Act, which said only free whites could naturalize, was in effect from 1790 until 1952. So that's 162 years of legalized racist exclusion where you could not become a citizen and subsequently couldn't own land because there were several laws passed in 1913 and 1920 in California called alien land laws in which they were basically if you were not a citizen, you couldn't own land. And these laws were specifically directed at Asians, primarily Chinese and Japanese, but also South Asians to an extent. Of course, Asians were very clever and they found ways to evade these laws. For example, the 1913 law had a loophole. And what many Asians did was to place that land in the name of their children or of a friend's children who were American-born and therefore citizens by birth. But again, by 1920, a second alien land law was passed in California which closed that loophole. But you had these alien land laws throughout the country, including places like Kansas, that had almost no Asians. And so, I mean, it's very much part of a racist hysteria that was codified into legalized racism through this series of laws, like alien land laws. Sorry, where were we before? What was the question? Okay, the cases. Yeah. Yes. Yes, so as a result of the Balsara case, there were a few South Asians, a few dozen, who were granted citizenship. However, that all changed when these citizenship cases went before the Supreme Court. And there are two Supreme Court cases that generally when we talk about citizenship, particularly Asian American citizenship, are of particular importance. And there in 1922, there was the Ozawa case in which Ozawa came before the United States Supreme Court and said, look, I went to Berkeley High School, I went to the University of California, we speak English at home, my family goes to a Christian church, we are Americans in every way. And then he actually showed, he pointed to his skin, he said, look, my skin is actually much whiter than Southern Europeans who have been granted citizenship. So the Supreme Court, in response to this particular petition, said that you may be white, but you're not Caucasian. So the following year, Bhagat Singh Thind brought another case before the Supreme Court, again seeking naturalization, as did Ozawa. And his evidence was that, because again, the court the previous year had said that Ozawa may have been white, physically his skin appeared white, but he wasn't Caucasian. Thind said that anthropologists classify people from South Asia as members of the Caucasian race. So using anthropological evidence, he said, I am Caucasian, and therefore I should be granted citizenship. And again, this is very important because, I mean, the thing with the early Asian migrants was because they were not citizens, they couldn't own land. And that's pretty central considering the majority of these folks were working in the agricultural industry. In addition, there were numerous other, and I mean, of course, voting is important, but there were more basic realities, that fundamental realities that citizenship was definitely necessary for, that, you know, made it extremely important. That's why so many South Asians, you know, filed so many lawsuits trying to become citizens. So anyways, in the Thind case, 1923, he says, you know, I'm Caucasian, according to anthropological evidence. So the Supreme Court says that, yes, according to anthropological evidence, you may be classified as Caucasian. But in the opinion of the common man, this is actual wording, in the opinion of the common man, you're not white. And that's pretty remarkable for the Supreme Court, too. I mean, if you look at the case, it's actually really remarkable. The mental gymnastics that the Supreme Court goes through in order to justify racism. And particularly, I mean, the justification of the common man, since when does the Supreme Court care about what the common man thinks in making a decision? So it's a really remarkable case. And, you know, in back-to-back years in which one year they say you're white but not Caucasian, and the next year they say you're Caucasian but not white. And so as a result of the Thind decision, several dozen South Asians retroactively lost their citizenship. Again, we're talking about a small number of people, right? We're talking about maybe four to 6,000 people. And primarily in California. I mean, they were scattered throughout the West, as far as Utah, Salt Lake City, down. Yeah. They lived primarily in California, but they were scattered in small pockets throughout the West. As far south as Arizona, there was an article in the local Arizona paper that talked about a sick man who'd moved there and using irrigation techniques from his homeland in the Punjab had made the desert bloom. And there's also evidence of South Asian communities as far east as Salt Lake City at this time. Well, again, the notion of community is very fluid. I mean, these were folks who were doing migrant work. So the notion of having an actual community where people stick around from year to year and develop families, it just wasn't the case, because one of the fundamental realities of that series of immigration laws that was passed, that were passed in this time period, was that women were prevented from migrating. Because the U.S. wanted their labor, but they did not want Asian American communities to form. And so again, race and racism were central to this. And this time it came out in the form of gender bias. Now, for South Asians, this was particularly prominent. All of these groups, right, all of the early Asian migrants, whether they're Japanese, Filipinos, Koreans, or Chinese, as well as South Asians, were essentially bachelor societies for a long time. And it was only subsequent years that families were able to reunite, because women were intentionally excluded so that families could not be created in this society. But for South Asians, it was by far the most acute problem, because less than 1% of the California population in 1914, of South Asians, within the South Asian population, was female. Well, they really had no recourse in many ways. Bhagat Singh Thind was an exception, right? He was educated. And the majority of people were, as I mentioned, Punjabi rustics. These were people from rural Punjab without educations, who didn't speak the language. And, you know, there were exceptions, of course. But by and large, the community really had no recourse. And the Supreme Court tells you in 1923 that you're not good enough to become a citizen. It's a pretty powerful indictment. There's not a whole lot you can do in a situation where white supremacy has been codified into law. And so they had no recourse in many ways. Sure. there's no reliable evidence as to what percentage of these folks were married, of the early migrants. So it's assumed that many did have families in South Asia. But again, I mean, this is basically, you know, the fact that women were excluded was tantamount to sexual torture. I mean, it's very much a form of torture to prevent people not only from having families, but from meeting a very basic human need of sexuality. And so for South Asians, they didn't have access to white women either, because part of the benefits of white supremacy is you can control who has access to women of various races. And so it was against the law for Asian men to, basically the term is miscegenate, a very ugly word, to engage in miscegenation with white women. And since there were no South Asian women, essentially they had no option except in certain cases in places called, like the Imperial Valley in Southern California. Punjabi men actually married into the Mexican-American community. And so you had the creation of a whole new bicultural community, of which scholar Karen Leonard has called the Punjabi Mexicans. Well, it's a very ugly word. I mean, if you look at the words that you know that have a prefix mistake, I mean, that have the prefix M-I-S, mistake. Sorry, I just had a long night. Can you think of some other words to start with M-I-S? I'm sorry. Okay, good. Okay, well, if you think of the words that start with the prefix M-I-S, they all have a very negative connotation, mistake, misgiving. And so when you talk about interracial sex and attach the prefix mis to it, it attaches a negative connotation, right? And, I mean, we realize that race is a socially constructed fiction, yet this not only reifies it, but it also attaches tremendous negative baggage to sexual relations between people of different so-called races. So that's why I think it's a really ugly word. There are, if you go to El Centro, California, I don't know if this is still the case, but several years back, maybe 6-7 years back, I met the mayor of El Centro. His name was David Singh Dillon, and he told me how his grandfathers were Punjabi Sikhs from India, and his grandmothers were Chicanas. And so I don't know if there is an actual community, but I think there are certainly people in that area, in the Imperial Valley, who are certainly well aware of this history, and they carry it with them. And actually, no, I don't want to get into a critique of the scholarship in the area. I don't want to diss my colleagues. But it's just that I think some of the scholarship has failed to really recognize the unique culture that was created. I think some of the scholarship in the field tends to give precedence to the Mexican culture, saying the Punjabis basically blended in. But, I mean, when you talk to folks from that, and, you know, Jane Singh has told me about this as another scholar in the field. She talks about how there certainly is a unique amalgamation of culture that's been created. And certainly the Punjabis contributed a great deal to that mixed culture, that mixed race community culture that had arisen. I don't think you can really generalize. I mean, I think they're very warm people, but I mean, they're very much an agricultural people. I mean, it's hard to generalize about stuff like this without being racist. So, they're an agriculture. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I think like most Asians, family has a very primary role in Punjabi culture. Absolutely, absolutely. But I mean, as I also said, I mean, I think it's very much tantamount to sexual torture. It's a form of torture to prevent not only families from forming, but for these men whose labor you want, to basically not let them have their lives as well. Okay, well, a lot of the migrants that came into the United States actually came from Canada. So when you study, unlike most other groups, when you study South Asian American history, it's inextricably linked to what happened in Canada, because a lot of the first South Asians that came to the United... Oops, sorry, hit the mic. A lot of the South Asians that came... That's another Punjabi characteristics. We talk with our hands a lot. Sorry. Okay, so a lot of the first South Asians who came to the United States, to North America, came as a result of the Queen's Silver Jubilee anniversary. I think it was 1898. And that was in Canada. And many of them were former British Army members, a lot of them six, and they chose to stay on. And again, as further south in the United States, they were not welcomed. But Canada had a different relationship because Canada was a part of the Commonwealth. So technically, as India was also part of the British Commonwealth, they should be able to migrate wherever they want within the British Commonwealth. However, there was a reaction there that basically Canada was, you know, like with the United States, that Canada was a white man's land. And so many of them were pushed out of Canada into North America. And so a lot of the first jobs were certainly agricultural. These were an agricultural people coming from, you know, a region known for agriculture. And most of them were from agricultural families, which is why they weren't they were a relatively uneducated group in terms of formal education. So once they got into the United States, places like Washington and Oregon, they also got into the lumber industry. And this is also in Vancouver to an extent. But in a place like Bellingham, Washington, I think it was 1913. You should probably not include that year. But in Bellingham, Washington, actually, I could look it up real quick. Can you wait 1 minute? I have my book. Good thing I brought this with me. Okay. Let's just say in the first decade of the 20th century. I'm not sure exactly what the year was. I think it was 1907, but I'm not positive. So in the first decade of the 20th century in Bellingham, Washington, there was a race riot in which the South Asians were expelled from Bellingham. And, you know, racial violence was certainly a very common feature of life in the early American West in the late 1800s and early 1900s, in which Chinese, Japanese, South Asians, and other Asians were basically lynched with impunity. And this was a situation in which essentially all of the South Asians, several hundred of them, were run out of the town of Bellingham, Washington, by a race riot. Well, lynching was commonplace, you know, basically murders. You know, I'm not saying that they hung somebody up from a tree, but basically there was, you know, wide-scale racial violence against Asians in which they had no recourse. Because there was because of one California law, Chinese were not able to testify in court in California, and that later was transferred to other Asians, not even in their own defense. So basically, they had no rights, you know, kind of like blacks in the South, other than what a white man was willing to give them. And so, I mean, that's a really powerful indictment that you're not even able to testify in court. That's a very powerful encoding of legalized racism. So, anyways. Because of these various racial incidents, including these large-scale racial mob attacks, South Asians tended to congregate in rural areas. They didn't have the numbers to form Chinatowns or Japantowns, so they never had large communities like the Chinese and Japanese. And so, therefore, one of the ways to avoid aggressive white violence and xenophobia was to locate yourself in a rural area. And certainly that, you know, fit with their previous pattern of having come from rural Punjab. But the location of Punjabis away from urban centers certainly had a great deal to do with fear of white violence and racism. They really worked throughout the entire Central Valley, all the way from Yuba City down to the Imperial Valley. I mean, throughout the Central Valley as well as the Imperial Valley. These large agricultural regions, because this was just when these regions were becoming burgeoning agricultural heartlands for the state of California and the American West. Okay, before I answer that question, actually I forgot to mention, in addition to working lumber, South Asians also worked on building railroads throughout California and the West. And it was after the railroad ended, like the Chinese, that they began to move in large numbers into the agricultural industry of the state of California. Okay, the other question. So initially, they were certainly welcomed by employers, because again, they saw them as a lot more reliable than their white working class, than the white working class. But it was, as with other Asian groups, the reaction was from the white working class, who saw them as threats. And it was because of that racist reaction that some employers were forced to stop hiring South Asians, although they certainly demonstrated a preference for hiring Asian workers and South Asian workers. Yeah. Well, I mean, if you look at the birth, I mean, the whole building of the labor movement in California was based on racism. You know, first anti-Chinese and then anti-Asian in general. You know, I mean, that's the history of the American working class, that, you know, most, the American labor movement was basically solidified on the basis of racism towards blacks in most of the country, but in the West Coast, it was based on anti-Chinese hysteria and propaganda. Well, I mean, I don't think the working class ever was welcoming. You know, as soon as the first South Asians came, the media started talking about the tide of turbans coming and how this was the latest surge of people from the Orient. Because one of the things that certainly is ever-present in this time period is the notion of Asians as the yellow peril, or as... One of the things that's certainly present in this time period was the notion of Asians as the yellow peril, that these first migrants from Asia are actually the first shock troops before a gigantic invasion of Asians. And again, I mean, this is ridiculous if you look at the numbers, right? But, well, as I mentioned earlier, you know, South Asians, we're talking 4,000 to 6,000 people, Koreans 7,000 maybe, Chinese, I think their highest level is about 150,000, and Japanese slightly more than that. Because, so I mean, as I mentioned, you know, there was one year in which there were 100,000 people, just 130,000 people, just from the country of Italy. So comparatively, compared to the white migrants from Europe, the numbers were small. But in terms of their impact, because of their racial difference, why is this guy taking my video camera picture? Sorry, there's a guy taking picture. Oh no, it's just that I'm not dressed. I just woke up and rolled. I really don't want my photo taken. Oh, okay. Yeah, okay. Sorry, what were we saying? What were we talking about? Yeah. Okay. Well, I think the media is one of the main sources of fanning the flames of racial hysteria. With the Chinese, certainly the Celestials who came, and the Chinese initially were welcomed, but I don't think that welcome was ever accorded to South Asians, because the Chinese were referred to in the media as the Celestials, right? The influx of Celestials. And initially they were welcomed, but the thing was, South Asians didn't come till almost half a century later. And by that time, anti-Asian racism was firmly entrenched in California. As a matter of fact, there was a group called the Chinese and Japanese Exclusion League. I'm sorry, I think it was the Japanese and... let's not get into that. But there was an anti-Asian group that specifically changed its name in the early part of the 20th century, because it was focusing primarily on East Asians, to the Asiatic Exclusion League, specifically to include South Asians. So South Asians came into, you know, they didn't arrive somewhere with a blank slate. They came into a, you know, there certainly was not, it wasn't a historical vacuum. There were 50 years of anti-Asian sentiment that preceded their arrival. Absolutely, yeah. Not off the top of my head. I mean, I could certainly dig some up, but not. Well, I mean, they refer to the tide of turbans that was coming, and they refer to Punjabis as dirty and basically an unwelcome addition to the American polity. And certainly the fact that they didn't speak English and looked different was certainly part, I mean, that was part of it. But in addition, they're very visible physical differences, I think, really stood out. And that's what the media focused on, focusing on the difference of the turban, of the fact that some were Muslim and that not that they weren't Christian. I don't think you can limit it to just race. I think it wasn't just white supremacy, but certainly Christian supremacy that was operating. The notion that any non-Christian was basically going to be damned for all of eternity, but also that these people were heathens. The Chinese also were called heathens. And so I think it's important. I think that's one of the factors that the historiography is really ignored, is the racial is not just the racial bigotry, but the religious bigotry and the way they intermingled and, I feel, magnified each other. And the media was central in spreading this type of hysteria. And I think that's what explains how the Chinese Exclusion Act was passed, despite the fact that almost all Chinese were just in three states. Certainly it was the media. Well, the thing with South Asians, they were specifically, the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882. In 1907, there was a gentleman's agreement between Theodore Roosevelt and the Emperor of Japan, which excluded Japanese. So that same year, beginning in 1907, there were executive restrictions put in place by the president to limit the number of South Asians. But when you get to 1917, there was basically an immigration act that limited the migration of almost all Asians. And so it was part of a general exclusion, as well as in 1924, the Immigration Act, which essentially cut off, the 1924 Immigration Act, which essentially cut off all migration from Asia until the 1950s. Well, in 1952, the United States passed the McCarran-Walter Act, which finally, after 162 years of racial exclusion, ended the prohibition against non-whites naturalizing. And as a matter of fact, actually in the midst of the Second World War are when Asians were finally allowed to begin to naturalize, because it was very apparent that if we're fighting a war for democracy, it's incredibly hypocritical to have these laws that prevent people from China and Asia and other parts of Asia from becoming naturalized citizens, and especially since the Chinese were our allies. So in 1943, the Chinese were allowed to become naturalized citizens. In 1946 for Filipinos and South Asians, and then 1952, the McCarran-Walter Act, Japanese and Koreans were finally allowed to become United States citizens. Sure. Angel Island is sometimes referred to as the Ellis Island of the West, and I think that's an extremely poor comparison, because Ellis Island was essentially a stopping point for European migrants to get into the United States. Angel Island was, okay, I shouldn't call it a latter-day Guantanamo Bay, but it's real close. Angel Island was actually a site where the government prevented Asian Americans from entering the United States. And again, it was a very tortuous circumstance. You're sitting there in the middle of San Francisco Bay, which, you know, the weather is, you know, in the middle of the bay, it can be extremely harsh most of the year. Not just, you know, in the winter. And you can see, you know, just a few miles away, you can see where you want to go. You can see San Francisco. Yet some people were kept there for many months as they went through tortuous proceedings to determine whether they should be allowed to enter the United States. And I actually have a case file here of a man named Bishan Singh, and he arrived in 1916, and he was excluded on the basis, as was very common, of becoming a public charge. But see, this case was actually very interesting, because normally the exclusion was on a basis of 3-0. There were three commissioners that voted. The predecessor of the INS had the station set up, the immigration station on Angel Island, and they would go through extensive interviews to determine if this person was telling the truth, whether they had work, they could find work. And the most common the most common rationale for excluding Asians was that they were likely to become public charges. Essentially welfare recipients, that the state would have to pay for their care and their upkeep. And so Bishan Singh was excluded in 1916 on the basis of just that. But his case is very interesting because the commissioners actually had a dissenting vote. And that's because there were three rich, large landowners, three rich white large landowners, who had submitted affidavits via telegram for his on his behalf for his admission to the United States. All three described him as sober, industrious, and one said that it is difficult to get men of the proved reliability and steadiness of character of Bishan Singh. And it essentially says that as long as he has a business, that Bishan Singh will have a job with him. And there are two other gentlemen that basically reiterate the same qualities of him as an industrious, sober worker, a reliable worker, and someone they would be happy to employ again if he were admitted to the United States. Yet, the commissioner still voted 2-1 to exclude him. And if you look at the rationale for the one who dissented, he says very clearly, look, this man was here before. He found work then. There's every reason to believe he'll be able to find work now and support himself. And so he says, I cannot agree with the move to exclude him, and I dissent. But the third commissioner voted to exclude him, and therefore Bishan Singh was prevented from entering the United States. And his case is really unique, because in most cases you don't have this type of clear-cut racism. But this man was here previously, and he went back. And he developed a reputation, as well as proven that he could take care of himself in the United States. And so this is very stark evidence of the manner in which race was central to the exclusion of a number of Asians who came through Angel Island. Right? It certainly was not a stopping point where you were allowed to change your name, make it a little more American, and just basically move on into New York City. Angel, absolutely, yeah. Well, even now, if you look at the barracks, okay. On Angel Island, there were a number of barracks, and that's where the potential immigrants were kept. Men and women were separated, and often they were separated by ethnicity as well, depending on where they came from. And to this day, one of the things that recently Congress just allocated a great deal of money, finally, to help preserve the barracks in Angel Island, because if you look on the walls, there are poems, very heartfelt, painful poems that the Asian migrants wrote in their native tongue. When I was there last, I actually found I've found some writing in Punjabi. Basically, a gentleman wrote his name. the light wasn't great in there, but I mean, it was obvious that Punjabis had written something. Some Punjabi migrant had written something there. And again, this stuff is I don't know. I doubt it. It's a pretty small island, and again, it was essentially a way station. People weren't there for weeks and months. Many times they were just there for a matter of hours. So that's a qualitative difference in the white immigrant experience and the non-white immigrant experience. Hello? Oh, okay, sorry. Okay. Well, I mean, they would be incarcerated, essentially. They couldn't leave the island. They were seeking admission to the United States, and while their case was being determined whether they should be allowed to be admitted, they would be there for days, weeks, months in some cases. And I mean, like I was saying, it's a very tortuous existence. You can literally look across the bay, and just a few miles away, you can see where you want to go. But the United States government is preventing you from going there. I don't have numbers, but yeah, a significant number of people were excluded, probably a majority. And again, it was all on the basis of this racist hysteria that we had to find some way to stop this tide of turbans, or previously the invasion of these East Asians who were described as a yellow peril by the media, politicians, and white labor leaders. Well, the Punjabi community and in Canada was far more organized, and they were able to petition the Canadian authorities, and then eventually they even sent a delegation to London. However, the Punjabis in the United States were not nearly as organized. They were far more dispersed because of the nature of the California agricultural industry and the fact that some were working in lumber, times some were working on the railroads, and they were far more dispersed. And so the notion of community was really not the same as, you know, the notion we see of Chinese community, in which you have an actual Chinatown in big cities where the Chinese communities, I mean, Chinese from all over the region come. You didn't really have anything similar with South Asians. The only thing close was the only institution they had really in the United States. Excuse me. The only institution they really had in the United States was the Sikh Gurdwara in Stockton, which was the first Gurdwara built in North America. A Gurdwara is a Sikh temple. Yeah, so it was the Sikh temple, the Gurdwara in Stockton, California. And I think it was either 1913 or 1917. I can't remember exactly. Yeah, it was in the 1910s. Well, it became a community center, not just for Sikhs, because it is a Sikh temple, but Muslims and Hindus would go there. It became not only a religious center, but a cultural center and a political center. It was out of that Gurdwara and out of Berkeley, California, that the Gaither Party was born and did a lot of its work. The Gaither Party, Gaither, which means revolution in Urdu, the Gaither Party undertook the prodigious task of trying to free British India from the yoke of British imperialism. It was a rather remarkable group. It was primarily composed of working class rural people. But its leaders were educated people, many of them who were either working or students at UC Berkeley or at Stanford. And their goal was to get the British out of India and to free India from the yoke of British imperialism. And they actually went to the point of sending a delegation to Germany and buying guns from the Germans. And actually there was an ill-fated... They had a ship and guns, and there's an ill-fated, actually, mission in which they attempted to land on Indian soil and engage in armed conflict. They were all arrested because the British knew they were coming. I can't remember if there was a leak or something, or a spy. But they were all arrested on their arrival and incarcerated for many years. But, I mean, they took their revolution very seriously. They went to the point of actually buying guns and... communicating with an enemy of the British, the Germans. No, I think we did a pretty good job covering most of the essentials. Well, I think September 11, 2001 was a very significant date in South Asian American history. Because I think up until that point, many South Asian Americans who were financially successful believed that their gated communities and their luxury cars and their income could insulate them from American racism. So I think 9/11 was a real wake-up call for the South Asian American community. And subsequently, you've seen a great deal more of community activism and community unity, as well as political activity, community service work. Until that point, I think most South Asian communities were fairly insular. And that was certainly because of a lack of acceptance, even in modern day, by the broader general white Christian community. I think they were strangers in many ways because of their obvious physical differences, their dark skin, and as well as their religious differences, whether they be Muslims, Sikhs, or Hindus. And so, you know, a lot of people don't realize that, you know, 9/11 wasn't that different for people who wear turbans in this country. Long before 9/11, wearing a turban in this country was essentially like walking around with a target on your head. That's why I was so upset at the media. I mean, I wrote some very harsh critiques of the media. This type of violence against Sikhs and Sikh temples, gurdwaras throughout the country. I was actually living in Ohio at the time, and the gurdwara nearest me in near Cleveland was firebombed. And, you know, this happened in several gurdwaras across the country, as well as several Hindu temples, as well as several mosques. So the point was that, you know, this happened in the 1970s with the Iran hostage crisis. This happened again after Oklahoma City. There was every reason to believe that this type of racial hysteria would break out again. Yet the media was very late after 9/11 in dealing with a national hate crime epidemic of truly historic proportions against basically anyone who appeared Muslim. So I think that was a real wake-up call for the South Asian community, because I think many of these people weren't post-65 immigrants, many of them who are highly educated. And I mean, that's not to say that the majority of the South Asian community is wealthy anymore, because certainly after 1980 you had a far less educated stream of migrants. Many of them were brothers and sisters of the initial migrants. And in a third world country that's, you know, still suffering the ravages of colonialism, as well as corruption and widespread poverty, many families could only afford to educate one child. And maybe that child was the doctor or engineer who migrated to the United States. And then using the family preference clauses of the 1965 Immigration Act, they later brought the rest of their family across, many of whom were not educated. And so these are the folks who'll be working, driving cabs, working in liquor stores or gas stations. So I think in many ways, I lost my train at thought. What were we talking? Oh, yeah, post 9/11. So, I mean, I think in a lot of ways, I think racism is more covert than at that time period, as well as religious bigotry. It's not as obvious, but it certainly comes out. For example, when the Sikh community wants to build a temple, right, when they want to build a gurdwara in a white Christian community, almost uniformly, you see a great deal of opposition arising that these folks don't want a Sikh temple in their community, which is, I mean, it's... And they're always the same arguments that are proffered. Parking, noise, you know, as if, you know, and again, it's based on gross ignorance of what Sikhs actually do in their religious ceremonies. For example, there was a Buddhist temple that was being built in California, and some of the opposition felt they didn't want the Buddhists in their community because they thought that Buddhists engage in animal sacrifice. And so, I mean, I think it's really important to look at not just religious bigotry and the entrenchment of white supremacy, but the way religion plays a central role in the type of difference that's created in these communities and the kind of difference that isolates South Asians, for example, from white Christians. So I think it's a combination of racial as well as religious bigotry. I'm going to be able to listen to the edit before you send it off to... Okay, great. Cool. Okay. Oh, yeah, John's still there.